The following program is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. Neither the stations that air this show, their management, their underwriters, their members, nor their seventh-born sons are responsible in any way, shape, or form for anything you hear on this program, nor do they necessarily agree with the views expressed on this program. Broadcasting from Hollow Earth Radio, soon to be KHUH, 100.3 LPFM in Seattle, Washington, and once in a while from Free Radio Olympia, 91.9 FM in Olympia, Washington. It is time for the Thunderbolt. Yes, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day, you turned on your radio, and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids, the thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee! All right. Hey, kids. It is September 29th, 2017. This is a fifth Friday, which normally means it's time for the Thunderbolt's Greatest Strikes, wherein I comb my archive for the most high-wattage Thunderbolts that I can find and replay them. But this week, what I'm doing is replaying one of the very first Thunderbolts I ever produced. And this was back when the show was still called the Oli Oli Action Alert. It was not even the Thunderbolt yet. And this was recorded by lying on my bed with my stereo speakers behind my head. So anyway, this is called the FBI Special, and it initially aired on April 28th, 2013. Enjoy.
Hey, kids. It's a special FBI Day edition of the Oli Oli Action Alert! Scary stories for you tonight, kids, because the big bad wolf in the form of the Federal Bureau of Intimidation has come to feed in the Olympia area. Beware.
Alert the village. Predators are on the prowl.
But we will rise. We will stand together, because together we are strong. And divided we will fall. Perhaps you will not prove astonished upon learning that I, your humble producer, commentator, and writer of the Oli Oli Action Alert, happen to have some information about those busy little bees in our Fibber Squad. founded by J. Edgar Hoover, who is notable not only for that, but also because he was probably the most successful extortionist and blackmailer of the 20th century. Not from a financial point of view, from a personal power point of view. That guy ran most of our government for a long time. The FBI is by this point pretty much an autonomous organization that does whatever the hell it wants, and the judiciary usually has their backs no matter the outrageousness of their conduct. Check out Leonard Peltier, an American Indian activist who has been in prison for 32 years for something he proved he didn't do. But since he's political, and since FBI agents were killed, he is the scapegoat. Check out Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney. The FBI blew up their car. They actually proved this. The FBI blew up their car, seriously injured both of them, like really bad, and then charged them with blowing themselves up, trying to say it was their own bomb that went off accidentally. Over and over and over again, kids, this is how they do their business. They are mean-spirited people. They are small-minded people. They live in a little bubble world that intersects with the actual world or fails to intersect with the actual world in very strange ways sometimes. And they are almost omnipotent. They can do pretty much whatever they want. However, Peltier, Berry, and Cherney were left-leaning activists and thus presented a sympathetic portrait. And tonight, I'm going to go into detail about how the FBI does things. And I'm going to intentionally focus upon a highly unsympathetic portrait and in order to detail at length the perfidy of the FBI. I'm going to focus on a gentleman named Randy Weaver. Now, Randy Weaver was a racist, far-right-wing, Aryan Nation kind of guy, and I figure that if I can get you to feel sorry for him, then I've done my job. Randy Weaver was a perfect victim. He was dirt poor. He harbored highly unpopular beliefs. He was a sheep out at the very outer edge of the flock, which is where the predators always like to feed. So federal agents developed the idea that they could threaten Mr. Weaver with several years in prison, and they could probably coerce him into snitching on all of his Aryan Brotherhood friends. Mr. Weaver had been to some Aryan Brotherhood meetings, and he actually had some problems with them and did not actually join their organization, but that was actually probably another reason the feds thought maybe he would turn snitch on them. So the feds employed a now common practice that until fairly recently was illegal called entrapment. And entrapment is when the police themselves offer some inducement to commit a crime so that the police can subsequently arrest someone for that crime. Get it? How long are we going to have before we fix this?
Only time will tell.
In effect, the police can offer incentive to an otherwise law-abiding citizen in order to create a crime when otherwise there would have been no crime. How long before we fix this?
Only time will tell.
Here's a scenario. They approach some, like, 18-year-old kid, offer him $100 to go buy $50 worth of heroin, okay? So this kid's, I mean, you know, let's say he's not a drug dealer, but he knows where to get some. Most kids do. He knows that you can probably get some heroin from someone else if you don't get it from him, and $50 is a lot of money for a kid. And so the kid goes and gets the heroin. Boom. He now has a felony drug record and virtually no chance of ever leading a lawful existence for the rest of his life.
Only time.
He's now completely under the power of the machine, which was the whole point to begin with. In Randy Weaver's case, a federal agent offered Mr. Weaver a large sum of money to cut off the barrels of a couple of shotguns, contrary to federal law. Randy Weaver had never before owned an illegal weapon. At no time in his life had he engaged in manufacturing illegal weapons. The idea of selling an illegal firearm had never entered his mind until said idea was planted and financially encouraged by said federal agent. Government knew that Randy Weaver desperately needed money. He had three daughters, a son, and a wife to support. He had a baby on the way. He lived in an isolated cabin without electricity or running water. And actually, I have been right to that area before when I was smuggling marijuana, and I know that area real well. Rather ironic. Randy Weaver was not a criminal. He made his living honestly by chopping firewood and by seasonal logging. He had never received as much as a traffic ticket in his entire life. He was discharged honorably from the Army and with several meritorious citations. Heretofore, the only crime he had been guilty of was harboring unpopular beliefs. Winter's day, shortly after the shotgun incident, Mr. and Mrs. Weaver set out in their old pickup truck to buy some supplies. They saw another pickup that appeared stalled on a bridge. Like all good country people, Randy and Vicky stopped to offer assistance, whereupon they were surrounded by several heavily armed marshals, and Randy was arrested. So what can you say? The magistrate incorrectly informed Mr. Weaver that if he were convicted, he would probably lose his house, the only major asset that he owned. Then, using the usual methods of blackmail and coercion, federal agents insisted that Mr. Weaver become a snitch, and that if he refused, he would spend several years in prison. Was when the first instance of the failure of the government conspiracy occurred. Randy Weaver was an honorable man. He refused to betray those who trusted him by betraying those who trusted him. Randy Weaver told the FBI where it's stick it where the sun don't shine. We'll be right back. faced with the horror of losing their home, Randy and Vicki Weaver began to ask questions of each other. How could they win the case? The cad sawed off the shotguns, and the feds had him on tape selling them to an undercover ATF agent. If they became homeless, wouldn't the government take their kids? And so, with no help, no money, no legal counsel, and feeling the omnipotent might of the federal government, the Weavers decided to just stay in their mountain and pray. Randy Weaver failed to appear for his court date. Learning that the Weavers remained isolated, resolute, and armed, all because of the erroneous information provided by the federal magistrate, a local marshal suggested to the prosecutor, who was a grim and humorless man named Ronald Howen, H-O-W-E-N, that if Weaver received assurances that he was not in jeopardy of losing his home, he would probably surrender. Howen squelched the idea. These are types of matters probably addressed by a plea agreement in exchange for a guilty plea, but not for mere surrender. This was in spite of the fact that due to the nature of the charges, the Weavers were in fact in no danger of losing their home in the first place. Thus, the assistant U.S. attorney has scornfully rejected an opportunity to seek a peaceful end to this solution. Situation. During this period, the Weavers attacked no one. They threatened at no one. Vicki was pregnant and unable to see a doctor. Their mail was being delivered by friends and was first intercepted and read by the government. Strictly because he dared to challenge the government, the status of Randy Weaver's case was elevated to a major case, thus authorizing the marshals to take extraordinary measures. They surrounded the Weaver ranch with video cameras and listening devices. They noted that the Weavers never left their house without their firearms. One plan that the government agents concocted was to kidnap 17-year-old Sarah, who had committed no crime and for whom they had no arrest warrant, which made the police plan actually a prosecutable crime in and of itself. Not that the police would ever actually be prosecuted, because they virtually never are. Eventually, the plan to kidnap Sarah was abandoned. It's on paper, though. Instead, 18 months later, a crack team of trained government marksmen sneaked onto the Weaver property on a reconnaissance mission. Preparatory to a contemplated arrest. They wore camouflage suits and they gave no warning of their arrival. They had no warrant to search the place or to be on the property, and they never identified themselves. The Weavers owned three dogs, and one of them, Stryker, was considered a member of the family, and the children loved them with all their hearts. And this was like, you know, they loved this dog, and the dog discovered the intruders and he began barking at them. Randy, his friend Kevin Harris, and Randy's 14-year-old son Sam, thinking that the dogs had discovered a game animal, grabbed their guns and ran to investigate. Kevin and Sam went one direction while Randy went in another direction. Then, as is their wont, the agents shot and killed Stryker the dog. Fourteen-year-old Sam, seeing his beloved dog fall dead, returned fire. The government agents shot Sam in the arm. Sam turned around and began running away. Whereupon the agents then shot a 14-year-old child who was running away from them in the back. Kevin Harris witnessed the shootings and in an action that a jury later ruled to be fully justified self-defense, Kevin Harris shot and killed a U.S. Marshal named Deegan. I don't have a first name here, I'm sorry. Randy Weaver, who had taken off in a completely another direction, was not anywhere near the shooting. Marshals fired 14 rounds. Kevin and Sam fired 5. The marshals realized that they were in deep doo-doo. They had been repeatedly admonished by Washington not to engage the Weavers and at all costs not to injure any of the Weavers' children. And instead, they had shot one of the children in the back as he was running away. And so they employed the standard technique used by government officials in such situations, which are lies and cover-ups. At trial, they claimed that they did not know that they had shot a child. It was later proven that there was no way they could have not have known. They reported that they had been engaged in a horrendous firefight with possibly 1,000 rounds fired by the Weavers. This also was later proven to be a conscious lie. They reported that they were surrounded and required immediately reinforcement. Maybe you guessed it, but that was a lie too. The next day, they supplied an affidavit to the court that blatantly and falsely claimed that the Weavers had been shooting at the marshals from the back of a pickup truck. As always, when you shoot at police, they respond with 5,000 to 7,000 times as much force as they need to come after you. The FBI hostage rescue team was summoned. The leader of this team was named Richard Rogers, and the associate director of the Marshal Service, Duke Smith, and these two guys flew to Idaho. This all happened in Idaho, by the way. I don't know if I mentioned that. During the flight, they decided to change the rules of engagement. Now, they had no authority to change the rules of engagement. Their changing the rules of engagement is, in fact, illegal. The rule of engagement is a euphemism for the authority under which officers are authorized to kill citizens. So that's kind of an important law. Under this law, one can intentionally kill another only in self-defense or if a third person is in an imminent peril of death or serious bodily harm. Quote. This is a rule that is very plainly spelled out, and it's a rule to which the police are fully bound. In fact, since they have badges, and since they have the authority of those badges, and since they take oaths, I think they are more bound than we are even. And it is also a rule that is systematically ignored. In fact, I think it would be difficult to find a group of people who have less respect for the law than law enforcement. The Thus, during the flight to Idaho, Richard Rogers changed the rules of engagement to shoot on sight any armed adult. In case you can't believe what you heard or think you may have heard and had an ear fart or something, I will repeat that. He changed the rules of engagement to shoot on sight any armed adult. And I need a drink of water, so I'm going to take a quick break here and let you absorb that. So in these rules of engagement, there was no requirement, as required by law, for the person being shot to be threatening anyone. Thus, Mr. Rogers summarily changed the law of the land, and according to Eugene Glenn, who was the on-site commander at Ruby Ridge, he did this. This is a quote. He did this with the full knowledge and consent of Larry Potts, the assistant director of the FBI. The number two man at the entire FBI was alleged to have changed the law of the land by a bald secret order. It was an order providing that the FBI agents not only could, but that they should kill any armed adult at the so-called Weaver compound. This was literally an order for federal agents to commit murder. Rogers changed the law as any tyrant would, by overt edict, without the consent or even the knowledge of the people. Since they knew from their surveillance that the Weavers never left their cabin unarmed, Mr. Rogers was effectively issuing an order to execute the Weavers summarily, even those for whom there were no pending charges. Smith and Rogers arrived at Ruby Ridge to learn that the famous fire night fight was not happening, and in fact, it had never actually happened. The only sounds were being made by the hundreds of armed government agents surrounding the property, the rumble of the armored vehicles, and the thwacking of the helicopters. Under cover of darkness, this multitude secretly surrounded the Weavers, and the FBI made no offer of surrender. The next morning, Randy and his 17-year-old daughter Sarah and Kevin Harris left the cabin and headed toward a shed wherein lay the body of the dead Sam, the 14-year-old kid. They wanted to commune with him before burying him, you know. It was kind of like a burial ceremony. They wanted to say goodbye. But the FBI had other plans. An FBI sharpshooter named Lon, L-O-N, Horiuchi, H-O-R-I-U-C-H-I, without warning, shot Randy in the arm as he was walking back from the shed. Sarah began pushing Randy back towards the cabin. Kevin joined them. Randy cried out, "I'm hit," and Vicky, his wife, held the door open. And as she was holding the door open, she was cradling their newborn baby in their arms. He'd just been born, I believe, a few days before. Vicky cried, "Come in, get in here." And then Lon Horiuchi, the FBI sharpshooter, using his high-powered scope, who could admittedly see and hit a fly at 200 yards, shot Vicky Weaver through the brain, tearing half of her face away. Horiuchi claimed that he could not see her. This was in spite of his claim that he could see a fly at 200 yards, in spite of the fact that he shortly after the incident drew a picture of the scene clearly showing the two people at the door. However, this drawing, in spite of being a vital piece of evidence, was later illegally withheld from the defense attorneys. And while the judge excoriated the prosecution for this blatant and illegal act, no one was prosecuted, as usual. Instead, as punishment, the FBI was required to pay one day's attorney fees for the defense. The defense attorneys were working without any fees, and since the attorneys didn't want anything from the government, they made no effort to collect that one-day fee. And predictably, the government made no effort to pay it. Now, keep in mind that under normal circumstances, federal prosecutors can do pretty much whatever they want to do, and they can convict pretty much anyone that they wish to convict on pretty much any charge that they wish to convict them with. Also, under normal circumstances, federal law enforcement can tell whatever lies they wish on the witness stand and have those lies believed by juries. Since there is no accountability, even if they are caught lying under oath, this is precisely the reason that the practice of lying under oath has become such a common practice amongst law enforcement. However, shortly before Mr. Weaver's trial, yet another hitch appeared in the government conspiracy to railroad Randy Weaver. An attorney named Jerry with a G Spence agreed to defend Mr. Weaver. Now, Jerry Spence is one of America's great unsung heroes. He's spent his life defending the poor, the injured, the forgotten, and all of the other victims of corporate-controlled America. And Mr. Spence has never lost a criminal case, and he has received more million-dollar verdicts for injured citizens than any other lawyer in America. So Jerry Spence was born and educated in the small towns of Wyoming. He currently lives in Jackson Hole. One piece of evidence presented at the trial was a bullet from a .233 caliber rifle matching a rifle that they believed belonged to Mr. Weaver. But perhaps the FBI forgot that Mr. Weaver was carrying a shotgun that day, but whatever. And how was this evidence found? The FBI claimed that it was found in pristine condition, lying daintily on top of some leaves. It was probably almost cute, just sitting there on that leaf. It was not buried, it was not marred, it was not scratched, it was not bent, bruised in it, or otherwise blemished, except for the rifling, which conveniently allowed them to match it to what they thought was Randy Weaver's rifle. So they went to all these lengths to prove this was Weaver's rifle, but it wasn't Weaver's rifle, and it wasn't the rifle he was carrying that day. That rifle they matched it to belonged to 16-year-old Sarah, who was far away in the cabin at the time of the shooting of Agent Dugan. And Mr. Spence's prodding, the FBI agent who recovered the bullet finally admitted that he had placed the bullet there. Yet another criminal act known as manufacturing evidence. But again, you probably guessed this by now, there was no prosecution. Jerry Spence exposed all of the government's perfidy that I have described here, conducting an exhaustive and expensive investigation without any compensation from either Mr. Weaver or from the government. Before the trial, the FBI did a quick and dirty internal investigation that whitewashed the whole affair. The FBI investigated the FBI, and the FBI decided the FBI had not done anything wrong. However, at the urging of Jerry Spence and others, the Justice Department investigated, and as a result, several agents were given letters of censure. One agent was suspended for 15 days. Doesn't say whether with pay or not. The investigation noted significant defects in the indictment, and Mr. Howen was scolded for refusing to negotiate surrender terms and thus forced the Marshals Service to engage in extraordinary effort to plan and execute a non-confrontational alternative to require Weaver to respond to the warrant. And that was it. No one in law enforcement was indicted. No one in law enforcement went to prison. The Justice Department, despite the illegal killings of a child and of an innocent woman with a baby in her arms, did not choose to prosecute anyone in law enforcement. Yet the same Justice Department showed incredible zeal in order to prosecute two citizens who, in this particular instance, had committed no legal wrongs at all. They went after Weaver with all guns blazing. Rather than prosecuting any law enforcement officials for the murder of a child and a woman with a baby in her arms, the government instead chose to hyper-aggressively prosecute Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris for Mr. Harris's completely legal shooting of Agent Dugan. After an exhaustive and lengthy trial wherein the prosecution played no-holds-barred hardball, trying to prejudice the jury about Mr. Weaver's political beliefs while simultaneously trying to cover up for the complete lack of evidence, the jury acquitted Mr. Weaver of all charges except the failure to appear on the original gun charge. After several more years of legal wrangling, Mr. Weaver was eventually awarded a multi-million-dollar cash settlement in a civil suit. The outcome of Mr. Weaver's case is extraordinarily... this is important, actually. Keep this in mind. The outcome of Mr. Weaver's case is extraordinary due to the fact that the government was caught. And that came about only thanks to the extraordinary efforts of the extraordinary Jerry Spence. The illegal methods used by the government agents and the prosecutors in the Weaver case are not only common, they are standard operating procedure. And they are standard operating procedure because the government almost always gets away with it, and virtually nothing ever happens to them, even if they do not get away with it. And keep in mind that the Weaver case was world famous, and that the press kept a close eye on the proceedings, and they were there filming all this and interviewing people about all this. And if the government was willing to pull the kind of extra legal shenanigans they pulled as the whole world was watching, then just imagine what methods they employed in the vast majority of cases where nobody really gives a shite. The function of the legal system is not to provide justice or to preserve freedom. The function is to keep those in power, and to persecute anyone who challenges that power. How many people have been in prison for decades for stuff they didn't do and that were proved by DNA? Hundreds and hundreds of stories. A black man in Texas was convicted for rape strictly on the word of one white woman, in spite of the fact that the man's girlfriend stated that he was with her at the time. Later, the man who actually committed the crime confessed, only to have the judge accuse the confessor of lying. The judge failed to explain why someone would freely confess to a crime he didn't commit without any apparent coercion to do so. After 20 years in prison, this man was exonerated by DNA evidence after his case was taken up by the Innocence Project. The Innocence Project, by the way, you should give money to them because they are a highly successful organization dedicating to freeing wrongly convicted prisoners. And the Innocence Project does not lack for business. Hundreds of people, a lot of them on death row for like 20 years, are there finding out all these people are in prison. See, the entire criminal justice system is completely dysfunctional, and hardly anybody knows it, and even people who do know it don't seem to care. And that is like just another serious problem we have, I know, of the hundreds of serious crises that we face. But it's all part of a piece. It's how we treat each other. And these people are sociopaths, and they just come in, they're bullies. They are petty. They just, you know, they power trippers. They come in and throw their power around and ruin people's lives and don't even think about it. And they're not nice, okay? And we need to stay united against this, kids, because that is how we are strong. If there's enough of us, then we are immune to them. That's the trick, you know, there's got to be enough of us. So that's all my little prepared text I have here. I have actually a lot more on this subject, but I think I got the point across. Like, you know, what happened with Mr. Weaver. I have a lot of personal stories I can tell you myself because I've had run-ins with the federal law enforcement myself. And so, yeah, this is FBI Day at KOWA. This is KOWA 106.5 Low Power FM in Olympia, Washington. And we live stream at KOWALP.org. And we're having some problems with our transmitter right now, so actually it sounds a lot better if you stream it than it does if you try to dial it in. You can only dial the station in pretty much in downtown Olympia, but we're going to try to expand our signal soon. And we need basically some money and equipment and expertise to do that, so we're working on that. So be careful, kids. And come join us on Wednesday. There's going to be all day at Sylvester Park. It's basically going to be a big party and to unite and so we can stand together and be strong. So the regular Ole Ole Action Alert will be back next week at its regular time, the regular channel. See you next week, kids.
So that was the FBI special, recorded and aired on April 28th, 2013. For now, though, that's it, so it's time to get to work. And thus ends part one of the Thunderbolt, Why You Should Be Upset. Next comes part two, What Can Be Done About It? Across Cascadia, the masses are arising in response to the Olympia Action Alert! For the week of September 29th through October 6th, 2017. It's the Olympia Action Alert for Friday, September 29th, and every Friday. It's a peace vigil. They go from 4:30 to 6 p.m. at Percival Landing, 217 Thurston Avenue, Southeast. And this message came to me through Olympia 4. It's peace vigils at Percival Landing every Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. We will meet at the corner of 4th and Water Street. A great location for us since 1998. The Artesian Rumble Orchestra Street Band joins us at 5 with live music to support our vigil. Signs are provided to all comers. For information, you can go to olympia4for.org. So again, this is a peace vigil, Friday, September 29th, and every Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. at Percival Landing, 217 Thurston Avenue, Southeast. Also on Friday, September 29th, and also on every Friday, we have the Women in Black Silent Vigil. This is from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Heritage Park Fountain, 330 5th Avenue, Southwest. And this message came to me through Olympia 4. It's the Women in Black Silent Vigil, Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. on the south side of West 4th Avenue near the fountain. This has been their activity since 1988, and they are part of a worldwide network of women publicly opposing war and all violence. For information, you can contact Rosemary Barnhart at 360-866-7589, or you can email rosemary.b, as in boy, at comcast.net. And this event is for women only. So again, it's the Women in Black Silent Vigil, Friday, September 29th, and every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. at Heritage Park Fountain, 330 5th Avenue Southwest. And also on Friday, September 29th, we have a film screening. It's Charlie vs. Goliath. This will be at 6 p.m. at the Capitol Theater, 206 5th Avenue Southeast. Now I got this message from Bruce. It's Charlie vs. Goliath, with a post-film Q&A with Charlie Hardy, filmmaker Reed Lindsay, Bruce Wilkinson, and Felix Agulto. This will be Friday, September 29th, and this is presented by the Northwest Alliance for Alternative Media and Education. The doors open at 6 p.m. for the 6:30 showing at the Olympia Film Society's Capitol Theater. Q&A will be dynamic and exciting. Charlie vs. Goliath is a feature-length documentary about an ordinary man's extraordinary struggle to shake up the political establishment. It would be hard to find a more unlikely candidate than Charlie Hardy, a 75-year-old penniless former Catholic priest who spent nearly a decade serving the poor while living in a cardboard shack in a Venezuelan slum. In 2011, Charlie returns to his hometown of Cheyenne, Wyoming, and is shocked to see poverty, hunger, and homelessness. The election is considered the most lopsided in the country, and his friends say Charlie is tilting at windmills. But Charlie is convinced he will triumph even with all of the cards stacked against him. A 21st century Don Quixote. Charlie galvanizes a ragged band of young volunteers determined to make waves in Wyoming's elections, and in so doing to set a precedent for the rest of the country. The film provides an intimate portrayal of this resolute and uniquely charismatic septuagenarian while revealing an inside look at a campaign fueled by hope rather than by money. Challenging the belief that our political process is fair and democratic, Charlie vs. Goliath explores the question of how an honest and sincere person without money can make a difference running for higher office, and more broadly, whether, in the spirit of Don Quixote, it is worth fighting an unbeatable foe and dreaming an impossible dream. So again, this is a film screening of Charlie vs. Goliath, Friday, September 29th, 6 p.m. at the Capitol Theater, 206 5th Avenue Southeast. It's the Olympia Action Alert! For Saturday, September 30th, it's a march for racial justice. The time is to be announced, and this will be at the Washington State Capitol, 416 Sid Snyder Avenue, Southwest. Snyder is spelled S-N-Y-D-E-R. And this message came through the Media Island events calendar. It's a March for Racial Justice at the Capitol Campus, Saturday, September 30th, 2017. Olympia Surge, S-U-R-J, invites you to move into action to help build a long-lasting national grassroots movement for racial justice. We know that Olympia has its own white supremacy to confront, from the colonization of indigenous land and people to organized white supremacists and alt-right actions in our streets, to the violence officer Ryan Donald committed when he shot Andre and Bryson, to their unjust trial and incarceration. Olympia Surge will collect signatures in support of De-escalate Washington's I-940 and lift up the messaging from the Movement for Black Lives. This initiative, led by people of color who have been impacted by police violence, is a tangible way to change a racist system that targets people of color. Further, the stakes continue to raise for people of color, and the movement to end white supremacy needs more white people to commit to anti-racist action. I don't have any contact information here, but you can Google Olympia Surge, because I've done that before. It's Olympia, S-U-R-J. So again, this is a March for Racial Justice on Saturday, September 30th, at a time to be announced at the Washington State Capitol, 416 Sid Snyder Avenue, Southwest. It's the Olympia Action Alert! For Sunday, October 1st, it's the Media Island Community Potluck and Barbecue Gathering. This will be from 1 to 6 p.m. at Media Island, 816 Adams Street, Southeast. And I got this message through the Media Island events calendar. It's the Media Island Community Potluck and Barbecue Gathering, Sunday, October 1st from 6 to 10 p.m. at Media Island International, 816 Adams Street, Southeast in Olympia, Washington. We are holding an end-of-summer community gathering and wanting to invite our community partners and members. Come and socialize, network, and share what is happening with your organization and with you. We will do the same. We plan on this being a seasonal event, so we can also talk a plan for the fall. Hope to see you all there and have a happy September. For information, you can email Quinn, Q-U-I-N-N, dot Moley, M-O-L-I, at gmail.com. Again, that's Quinn.M-O-L-I at gmail.com. Or you can go to MediaIslandAllOneWord.org. So again, this is the Media Island Community Potluck and Barbecue Gathering, Sunday, October 1st from 1 to 6 p.m. at Media Island, 816 Adams Street, Southeast. It's the Olympia Action Alert! For Wednesday, October 4th, and every Wednesday, there is a peace vigil from noon to 1 p.m. at Sylvester Park, 600 Capitol Way South. And I got this message through Olympia 4. It's a peace vigil at Sylvester Park every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Meet at the corner of Capitol Way and Legion, as we have done since 1980. Signs provided if you choose, and bear witness to a friendly way for peace at one of our busiest downtown locations. For information, go to olympia4for.org. So again, this is a peace vigil, Wednesday, October 4th, and every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. at Sylvester Park, 600 Capitol Way South. Also on Wednesday, October 4th, we have a Michael Albert Lecture, Beating Trump, and Then What? This will be at 7 p.m. at Traditions Cafe, 300 Fifth Avenue, Northeast. And I got this message from Robert. Michael Albert is a founder and current staff member of Z Magazine. Michael's radicalization occurred during the 1960s. His political involvements started then and continued to the present. They have ranged from local, regional, and national organizing projects and campaigns to co-founding the South End Press, Z Magazine, the Z Media Institute, and ZNet. And I use those resources myself all the time, I might interject here. Michael has spoken all over the world about alternatives to capitalism and strategies to end capitalism, and he is the author of 22 books, including the just-published Practical Utopia, Strategies for a Desirable Society. Michael will also be giving a talk earlier in the day entitled Lessons from the 20th Century Revolutions at 11 a.m. at the Evergreen State College in the Seminar 2 building in room D1107. For information, you can email bobbygorill at gmail.com. That's B-O-B-B-Y-G-O-R-R-I-L-L. It's like gorilla with the A left off. Bobbygorill at gmail.com. For information about the Michael Albert Lecture, Beating Trump, and Then What? Wednesday, October 4th, 7 p.m. at Traditions Cafe, 300 Fifth Avenue, Northeast. It's the Olympia Action Alert! For Thursday, October 5th, it's not another mistake on the lake. This will be at 7 p.m. at Traditions Cafe, 300 Fifth Avenue, Northeast. And I got this message from Jakob. It's not another mistake on the lake. Please. A developer is planning on turning the Mistake on the Lake building into an even uglier penthouse condo development. We must resist this project, which will act as a beachhead for gentrification in Olympia and destroy any chance of turning this area into a public park and restoring the estuary. This is a fight just not over one building, but over the future of Olympia. We will strategize on ways to oppose this project through all available means. So again, this is Not Another Mistake on the Lake, Thursday, October 5th, 7 p.m. at Traditions Cafe, 300 Fifth Avenue Northeast. Also on Thursday, October 5th, we have a film screening, From the Ashes. This will be at 7 p.m. at the Olympia Unitarian Universalist Congregation, which is at 2315 Division Street Northwest. And this message came to me from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation. Join us for a free screening of the National Geographic film From the Ashes, which captures Americans and communities across the country as they wrestle with the legacy of the coal industry and what its future should be under the Trump administration. From Appalachia to the Montana coal plant that provides 30% of Redmond's power, the film goes beyond the rhetoric of the war on coal to present compelling and often heartbreaking stories about what's at stake for our economy, our health, and our climate. The film invites us to learn more about an industry on the edge of what it means for the lives of everyone involved, including ourselves. This screening is being sponsored by Olympia Indivisible, the Sierra Club, Green Sanctuary, OUUC, the League of Women Voters of Thurston County, Great Old Broads for Wilderness, then the Thurston Climate Action Team. So again, this is a film screening of From the Ashes, Thursday, October 5th, 7 p.m. at the Olympian Unitarian Universalist Congregation, 2315 Division Street Northwest. And I'm afraid that is it for the Thunderbolt this week, kids. But there is no need to destroy everything and everyone that you love. I'll be back next week with another show. And in the meanwhile, I have the bonus tip of the day to help get you through. Consider fibbing to the fibbers sometime. Haha, peace, and we'll see you next week. The Thunderbolt is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. Neither the stations that air the Thunderbolt, their sponsors, their members, their underwriters, nor anyone else that has much to do with anything else in any way, is responsible for the content of the Thunderbolt. Nor do they necessarily agree with the views expressed on the Thunderbolt. If you have any comments, or if you wish to express an opposing opinion, you should send an email to dana98501@gmail.com. And we will make arrangements. And I hope that you have a day. And a quick note here. The Thunderbolt is on Facebook, where you can find links to the show and to the show notes. Or you can go to radioforall.net. That's radio4all.net. Where you can also find the show notes, as well as a year's worth of downloadable episodes of The Thunderbolt. People who want to get involved in activism in Thurston County are signing up for The Thunderbolt, your weekly email guide to local activism. People who wish to subscribe to The Thunderbolt are sending emails to dana98501@gmail.com. That's Dana, D-A-N-A, 98501, downtown Olympia, zip code, @gmail.com.